Hey everyone, welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp and my guest is Dr. Joseph Farrell, and he's just blowing our minds here and discussing his book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. Joseph, before we leave the Nazi part of our discussion, there's something in your book where you mentioned scalar weapons, described as monstrous weapons on a daily basis. And, you know, I didn't realize it until I read your book that I'd seen other references to that, specifically in some discussions of zero-point energy. But could you tell us briefly what scalar weapons are, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and whether or not the Bell constituted one of them?
Well, scalar weapons are essentially weapons that are based on or that tap into, like you correctly pointed out, the zero-point energy. It's a rather long and involved technical description, and I get into some of that in the book. But again, basically, it's one way of analyzing the physics behind the Bell. In the new book that's at the printer right now, I analyze it from a slightly different perspective. It basically amounts to the same thing, that we're dealing with a physics that's tinkering with the very fabric of space and time itself, and the energy that's involved in it, which of course is enormous. But it's basically a kind of physics that was around prior to general relativity, and Tom Bearden and Nick Cook and some other people have written on these things as well.
The description of it being monstrous, is that monstrous in its potential or monstrous in how it was applied?
I believe both. I think that the Nazis, in experimenting with the Bell, exposed probably, you know, in addition to animals, they probably exposed some concentration camp victims to its field effects as well. So I think monstrous in terms of its applications, but certainly monstrous in terms of its potential, absolutely.
What also in the book you discuss about the creation of artificial rubies. How does that fit into this?
Well, that's an interesting comment, because it actually comes from the declassified Farm Hall transcripts, which, of course, were, again, those British secret recordings that they made of the German atomic bomb scientists. And one of them, a fellow by the name of Horst Korsching, just kind of makes this little passing reference to making artificial rubies. And, you know, that just kind of stops you cold, because, of course, artificial rubies were the optical cavity in the first laser that mankind built in the early 1960s. So, you know, again, what does this indicate about what the Germans are actually doing during the war? And there's always been persistent rumors that they were dealing with directed energy weapons of some sort. And a British author by the name of Tom Augustine in 1985 came out and just said flatly that they were working on lasers. So again, where they actually were and where we have been told they were in terms of their scientific achievement are really two very different things.
You think there's a possibility that the Germans actually created an atomic bomb?
Oh, yes, I do. Absolutely, I do.
And what's the evidence for that?
Well, it's again, a largely circumstantial case, but it kind of kicked loose when the Clinton administration declassified in 1992, very early into their administration, or pardon me, 93, an affidavit of a German test pilot who was flying a bomber, twin-engine bomber, out over the Baltic Sea toward the island of Rügen, which is over close toward where the Germans were building their V-2 rockets. And he described, in his words, what he described as an atomic bomb test. He saw a blast radius wave that was approximately a kilometer to a kilometer and a half in diameter, which would be the approximate size for a nuclear device. But more importantly, he describes the electrical malfunction of his equipment in his aircraft, and he describes a mushroom cloud, those are again his words, and continuing combustion of the nuclear material in the cloud, in terms of description of colors and hues and so on that he saw on the fireball. So in other words, this is a very important document, George, because we have in it a description, an accurate description of a test of a nuclear bomb, which no one has seen and knows how to describe prior to this point in history. So it's a very, very crucial document. And when we put that together with some of the other things I talk about in Reich of the Black Sun, the Auschwitz so-called synthetic rubber plant. And another interesting piece of information that I discovered was that during 1944, at approximately the same time as this German pilot saw this test, Great Britain put all of its constables, fire departments, and medical teams around the entire country on secret emergency alert precisely against the possibility of a German atomic bomb attack. So in other words, the circumstantial evidence after German reunification is beginning to point very clearly to a much more successful Nazi atomic bomb project than we have been led to believe.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what, here's the central question, perhaps the central question of the night. If we inherited or stole or acquired this technology, and if we've been able to master it, if we've been able to improve upon it, to make use of it, describe for me how it could be used now, what it could be used for, what kinds of things it could accomplish.
Well, if we extrapolate out from what I believe may have been some of the underlying physics of the bell, then, you know, we've had 60 years, or whoever has this technology has, and I'm convinced that somebody does, we've had 60 years since the end of the war to develop it. So there's no question in my mind that somebody on this planet has the ability to construct so-called over-unity devices, which really are not over-unity in the popular term, but simply radically much more efficient energy devices than we have in use now. But there's no doubt in my mind that somebody has that, and as a consequence of it, there is no doubt in my mind that somebody somewhere would have some sort of field propulsion capability. Now, as to whether or not anybody has been able to weaponize this, I don't know. My guess is probably so. And if that is the case, you know, then God help us all, because that, again, is a physics with a weaponization potential that is just absolutely enormous. It's far, far beyond our largest thermonuclear weapons.
Well, I guess we can safely conclude then that if they have it, they haven't used it. Nobody's uncorked a big bomb like that. Is there any evidence that that they use it for lesser things like time travel or whatever?
Well, again, I don't think that the device and the science would exist for practical time travel quite yet. But again, that is some of the nature of the byproduct of the physics that we're talking about. So certainly somebody, you know, humanity being what humanity is, somebody probably is tinkering around with it for that purpose. So again, you know, this stuff goes in any number of ways.
Well, one of the ways it could go is you speculate about the existence of a secret space program.
Oh,
and maybe we're using this thing to go to the stars and just not telling anyone about it. And we're going to talk to you about that when we come back right after this short break. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, your guest host. My guest is Joseph Farrell. We've been speaking about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell and learning a lot about history that isn't in the history books. You're blowing my mind here, Joseph.
Well,
I guess that's the point. Let's talk about the possibility that there are two space programs. You know, you hear these statements every once in a while from folks in connection with advanced technology that we have. Hints, for example, about what might have happened out at Area 51. You know, I heard that quote back in the late 80s, that there are things out there that would make George Lucas drool, and that we're 50 years ahead of anything you could imagine, and hints from people like the late Ben Rich that maybe we've already been to the stars and back.
Right.
Do you believe it's possible that we are using this technology in some other kind of space program that the public has not been told about?
Yes, I do, and let me get into some of the details why. Let's go back to that other scientist that I mentioned that was connected with the Bell, Dr. Kurt Davis, the one that I mentioned I have a picture of in the book with Dr. von Braun. He was, again, the one of the administrators at the Kennedy Space Flight Center during the Apollo mission. And this man is not even a rocket scientist. He's an electrical engineer. And again, he was the man that designed the power plant for the Bell. Now, I want to make something very clear before I proceed, and that is I am not, absolutely, definitely not one of those people that believes that the Apollo moon missions were hoaxed. I do not believe that at all. But I think that some of the anomalies that those people are pointing out are really signatures or indicators of an alternative technology that may have been deployed, not necessarily so much in getting us to the moon, but in getting us off the moon. And the reason I say that is, again, one of those things that the hoaxers point out that is an unusual signature for a rocket is that the lunar excursion module, the LEM, the television pictures that you see of that module taking off from the moon don't really look too much like the signatures of a rocket. The thing just sort of pops up and more or less flies away at a uniform, what appears to be a uniform rate of speed, which again, a rocket accelerates geometrically per unit of time. So that to me is a little indicator that there may have been an alternative technology involved in getting us off the moon that everybody wishes to keep quiet. And in that respect, I should point out another significant detail. Dr. von Braun himself gave an interview for Time magazine shortly after the first lunar landing, in which he quoted a neutral point for the gravitational attraction between the Earth and the Moon at approximately 43,500 miles from the surface of the Moon, which is not where it would need to be if the Moon were merely one-sixth the gravity of the Earth. If that were the case, that neutral point would have been much closer, something like 23 to 25,000 miles, if I recall my figures correctly, from the surface of the Moon. So in other words, the figure indicates that the Moon is possibly a much more massive object than we have been told publicly. And for that reason, then, it would have required a rather different technology than the mere rockets on the lunar excursion module to get us off the moon. So again, I think that there may have been an alternative technology in play during the Apollo missions.
And do you, to take it a step further then, do you believe then that it's possible we're using it now to zip around the solar system or the galaxy or something like that could be going on and we haven't heard about it?
Well, to crawl way out on a limb here, yes. I mean, if we go back to the speculation that this technology has been in existence since World War II, and then whoever has it has had 60 years to develop it, then yes, it's possible.
You mentioned Wernher von Braun a couple of times.
Right.
Any indication that he was involved in this research back in Germany?
Ah, that's an excellent question. Let's go back to the internal evidences of the Magic 12 documents. One of the things that kind of caught my eye when I read them was that in General Twining's so-called white-hot intelligence estimate, it mentions that they bring in the paperclip scientists to look at the Roswell wreckage. Now, I thought that a very peculiar thing for our military to be doing if it had suspected that that technology was extraterrestrial. Why would we be sharing one of our deepest national security secrets with a bunch of ex-Nazis who are tinkering with our rockets? I just don't think that security compartmentalization would have allowed that. However, one of the things that then goes on in the documents to describe is the technology that these German scientists, after looking at the wreckage, come up with. And it has all the appearance of being little indicators of connections to projects that the SS was involved with during the war. So on the basis of the internal evidence, then, yes, von Braun may have had some sort of inside knowledge as to other projects going on in Nazi Germany back when he was their chief rocket scientist. And again, we have to remember that this Dr. Kurt Davis was a member of his rocket building teams as well as one of the chief scientists involved in the Bell project.
Well, let's stick with Roswell for a second.
Sure.
The Roswell community, the community of Roswell researchers, isn't going to like the idea that this might have been some sort of a Earth technology that crashed there. What do you think crashed at Roswell?
Well, to be quite honest with you, again, going back to my argument from internal evidence, since the biological aspect of the story, and as far as the documents are concerned, is the part of the story that most cinches the case for ET in other people's minds about Roswell, and since that evidence in the documents is blacked out, on the basis of the extant internal evidence, then I have to conclude that it was a terrestrial craft. Now, what does this mean in terms of our military's response to it? if they're bringing in paperclip scientists, if that really happened, and for the sake of argument, let's suppose that it did, if they really did that, then the military is going to panic not so much because this is an ET craft that has crashed, but it's because it is something Nazi, and that means that somebody out there is continuing an independent line of development of this technology that is not under Allied or Soviet control.
Have you had much interaction with the UFO community about this theory? I mean, I just wondered if they'd jump all over you about it.
No, I have not. I've had people contact me quietly and say that I may be on to something here. I've interviewed with Whitley Strieber, for example, and he thinks that there might be an angle to this story that might indeed be terrestrial on that basis. But otherwise, no, I haven't had much reaction from the UFO community at all. It's more like deadly silence.
Well, like I offered before, we'll try to stir it up for you. See if we can rain some grief on your head here. In keeping with the Roswell area, you're familiar, of course, with Colonel Phil Corso.
Oh, yeah.
And his book, The Day After Roswell. You know, I got to interview him 5 or 6 years before that book came out and found it to be interesting. Give me your take on Colonel Corso, then. If you don't believe that the Roswell craft was E.T., then his story, a lot of it would have to go out the window, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it does. But I should point out that Colonel Corso himself, and I quote these little sections in my book, Colonel Corso himself indicated that there is some sort of connection to the Nazi paperclip scientists, but he doesn't really go into very much detail. But as far as the actual in allegations and claims that he makes in his book, one of the most interesting to my mind was his claim that the transistor was developed using seeded extraterrestrial technology that was borrowed from the Roswell crash. And he points out quite rightly that the history of the transistor is somewhat obscure prior to its announcement. But I point out in the SS Brotherhood of Abel, I even have a picture of this thing, of a little German klystron tube, which is a little vacuum tube, that is about as big as the last knuckle on your pinky finger. So it's a very small tube, and it was in existence and used by the Germans as early as 1940. Now, the Allied equivalent of this little tube at the end of the war is 10 times as large. So the Germans were making great strides in the miniaturization of electronic components for their secret projects. And the other thing that's very interesting is that the Germans were also making great strides in semiconductor technology, which is another necessary component on the technology tree to the transistor. So I subject a lot of these claims and allegations that Colonel Corso makes to this historical analysis, and in almost every case, I can find you some glimmer or some clue that there might be a Nazi antecedent to it.
So, like, there is a cover story for a cover story for a cover story. Corso
exactly.
Corso is telling people this is hinting that it was recovered from Soviet crashes, when in reality he believed it was from E.T., but somehow this may have been a cover for it was really from Nazi technology.
Right.
Well, is there anything, the other parts of what he said was about fiber optics coming
right.
from this and about, I think, night vision goggles, anything
right.
like that? You find any paper trail for that kind of research in Germany?
Well, in respect to infrared sight and night vision, the Germans were pioneers of that technology and actually had it deployed as early as the Battle of the Bulge in 1944. They equipped, I believe it was a battalion of Panther tanks with some infrared sights, and they fought with great effectiveness during the Battle of the Bulge.
Okay, well, we're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell, and when we come back, we're going to find out if there's a connection between all of this and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. We're getting our brains rattled by Joseph Farrell, who's written a book, The SS Brotherhood of the Bell, about secret Nazi technology that may have been acquired by our government and now in the hands of multinational corporations, and how it might have been confused. What we're thinking of as UFOs from outer space or some other dimension might be good old technology born here on Earth. And, you know, I'm looking at it, at the book, and I didn't remember seeing this the first time, but we're making comparisons between some of the technology that may have been developed there in Nazi Germany and what we consider to be UFOs. And there's a photo of Kenneth Arnold from his he's looking at a sketch of the vehicles that he saw, the first big UFO case of the modern UFO era. And then the comparison is made in the book to the Horton brothers' flying wing, something that was developed and flown in Germany as early as 1939. And boy, from a certain angle, they look almost exactly alike. That's one of the fascinating discoveries that that Dr. Farrell reports in his book. The other, perhaps most controversial part of it, is whether or not any of this stuff had to do and played a role in the assassination of President John Kennedy. And we're going to be talking to Dr. Farrell about that as soon as we take this break. I'll be right back with more Coast to Coast AM. Speaking with Joseph Farrell about the SS Brotherhood of the Bell. I mentioned before the break, Joseph, the uncanny resemblance between what Kenneth Arnold saw and sketched back in 1947 and the Horton brothers' flying wing. What's the significance of that comparison?
Well, the comparison is, as you pointed out, that they look almost completely identical. And the Horton brothers, as you mentioned, flew that flying wing in Nazi Germany as early as 1939. So, and again, much of their work and research was brought to this country, we know this for a fact, after the war, and it was stationed at Wright-Patterson Air Base, of all places. So again, the little dots connect in so many different ways, and it wouldn't surprise me that a company like Northrop, which was building its own flying wing, may have continued to develop their concepts on the basis of some of Horton's research. So it's my speculation, really, that probably what Kenneth Arnold saw that initiated the first UFO flap in this country after the war was something that may have been a development or even just plain old Nazi technology.
You think there's a connection between the atomic bombs that we uncorked at the end of the war and waves of UFO sightings in subsequent years?
Oh, yes, I do. I think that Stanton Friedman is exactly right, that they show up not without coincidence at our most sensitive military installations. But the thing that I point out is that they start showing up in our country in 1947, 2 years after our first atomic bomb test in New Mexico in July of 1945. But they also show up over the Baltic and in Scandinavia in 1946, which would place it 2 years after the German A-bomb test that took place in 1944. So in other words, we have a case where these UFO flaps are beginning to occur precisely 2 years after some of these tests. So, that's kind of a coincidence.
Well, let's pursue that further. Does it take them 2 years to get here from wherever they're coming from?
It may. That's anybody's guess. It may. It may very well.
All right, let's talk about JFK.
Sure.
This is a pretty controversial part of your book. We've heard in the UFO field, we've heard this for years, that maybe there was a connection, that JFK wanted to spill the secrets about Roswell or UFOs,
right,
or that maybe he told his brother Bobby and Bobby told Marilyn Monroe, and that's why Marilyn Monroe had to be killed as well. What is the connection to all of this, and what is the evidence that it might have a role in the assassination?
Well, let's go back a bit. There is a Nazi connection to the JFK assassination, and it's one of those connections that very few researchers really want to touch. In fact, the only one that I know of who did so rather extensively was the old talk show host, Mae Bressel. But let's go back to history and talk about another aspect of what would become Operation Paperclip. In 1944, Alan Dulles was the station chief for the OSS, which was the wartime version of the CIA, in Zurich, Switzerland. And he was approached by a German general by the name of Reinhard Gehlen, who was in charge of Germany's Fremde Heere Ost, which was its military intelligence analysis unit for all of the Eastern Front. General Gehlen ran a network of thousands of agents inside of the Soviet Union and inside of Eastern Europe as the war progressed. And he offered Dulles a deal. And the deal was that since he knew the Americans would need on-the-ground human intelligence inside of the Eastern Bloc after the war, he offered to turn over his entire military intelligence network to the American government in return for that network being kept in place, not prosecuted for any war crimes, and with him as the day-to-day head of operations. Now, pause and consider what that really means. It means that when President Truman signed the National Security Act of 1947 into law, the civilian character and charter of the CIA had already been compromised because, for all intents and purposes, the operational desk of the Soviet desk of the CIA was in the hands of a bunch of Nazis. And as subsequent history turned out and pointed out, many of these agents turned double agents for the Soviet Union, and that means the possibility exists quite clearly that they remained agents ultimately for some sort of independent Nazi combine and were working for their own best interest. So, you know, we have that little aspect of the story. Now, when President Kennedy comes along and signs that National Security Memorandum, I think it was 272 or 273, I forget the exact number right offhand, that in his own words, he threatened to smash the CIA into 1,000 pieces. He is taking direct aim at this coterie of Nazis that are using the CIA as a front to legitimize their continuing operations after the war. So in other words, on that point alone, the Nazis have a clear motivation to be involved in the Kennedy assassination. Now, there's another odd, interesting little detail that came out in the Warren Commission that very few researchers ever point out. And that is that one of Lee Harvey Oswald's Marine buddies not only heard him speaking Russian, but also speaking a language that he thought was German. And when Oswald was arrested, not only did he have the names of FBI agent James Hoste and his address and phone number contacts, not only did he have that name, not only did he have General Edward Walker's name and address and phone number, but he also had the name, address, and phone number of one George Lincoln Rockwell. And some of your listeners out there may be old enough to remember that man. I certainly am. I remember seeing him on TV.
Yeah.
That man was the president of the American Nazi Party. So the question is, what are these connections doing in Oswald's address book, and why? Why are they there? So you add all this together, there is, at least from the intelligence angle, a pervasive Nazi influence and therefore a motivation to be involved in the assassination. And they certainly would have had the means and ability to pull something like that off. They were masters at counterintelligence operations of that sort. On the technology side,
do you think that I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sure, no, go ahead.
Do you think that JFK would have known about the bell?
I think that he would most likely not have known about that, but that he certainly would have suspected, given his knowledge of the CIA and so on and so forth. He certainly would have been alarmed, as was President Eisenhower before him, of this pervasive foreign influence in the analysis and gathering of intelligence in the Eastern Bloc. And that highlights another little thing I want to bring up. I believe that when President Eisenhower gave his speech warning about the military-industrial complex, that he wasn't warning just about ours. He was warning about the Nazis as well, because he had just fought that military-industrial complex in the war. He knew its outlines, its shape, its mechanisms, its motives, and so on and so forth. So there's all of these connections to the Kennedy assassination that really don't get much attention in the assassination research community that I think need to be brought out.
And have you taken it further to analyze how this fits in with other kinds of the physical evidence about how the assassination was carried out and the other theories that the mob or CIA or others were involved?
Well, I do mention it. I do mention all of those aspects. But the one thing that kind of sticks out to my mind as the group that would be most affected by Kennedy smashing the CIA as he planned to do, would have been this rogue network of Nazis ostensibly working for the American government, and then by that time, of course, for the West German government as well. So I think he had to have at least suspected that there was perhaps a technological aspect of this story too. And if the Nazis were involved in it, and particularly if they had any sort of independent programs going on that were being coordinated by this intelligence group of General Galen's, then yes, they would have had a clear motive to be involved in the assassination.
Tell me this. I know, you know, history has taught us that that there were isolated instances of Nazis, high-ranking Nazis, escaping and living for decades in South America, etc. Do you think that there is evidence that, that any kind of substantial number of Nazis were able to get out and carry on and carry out their existence, their programs, whatever, outside of Paperclip, outside of our government?
Oh, yes, I do. In fact, General Juan Perón, who was at the time president of Argentina, built four these Nazi scientists prior to the end of the war and had ready and waiting for them after the war a modern, for its day, a very modern plasma physics research laboratory in San Juan de Bariloche province of Argentina, which is very remote over toward the border of Chile. And if you look at the photos of, and I have some photos in my collection of the German settlements there, they look like little Bavarian chalets. It's just like a little bit of transplanted Germany. And these scientists went to Argentina and actually continued their plasma physics research. Even some rumors involved them in researching fusion physics. So in other words, yes, there was a clear financial and personnel and security apparatus that the Nazis put in place inside of South America after the war that allowed them to have a sufficient infrastructure to continue some of these projects. Absolutely.
You know, you hear these stories over the years about the Nazis, a lot of them escaped. They built a secret base in Antarctica. Others say that they might have a, you know, some kind of base in the hollow earth, things of that sort. Any indication that about the Antarctica part of it, at least?
Well, yeah, again, you know, this is another aspect of the story that is so very bizarre. The Germans sent an expedition to Antarctica in 1938 and early 1939, ostensibly for the purpose of claiming portions of it, but they outfitted a seaplane tender on this expedition with a shipboard scientific laboratory. They recruited a bunch of scientists. They went down there. They collected shot penguins and walruses and froze them to take them back to Germany to learn how to make nutritional food out of them. And then they flew planes over a huge area of Antarctica, claimed it for themselves, and did basically nothing but photographic mapping. And there have always been persisting rumors that they found warm water springs, caves in the ice, and so on and so forth, which they turned into bases. Now, there's really no substantiating evidence for any of this except two very odd facts. The first fact is that the sponsor of that Nazi expedition to Antarctica before the war was none other than Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, the head of the German Luftwaffe. Now, this is not a man that's going to be sponsoring a science project. He has a completely military purpose in mind, but no one really knows what it is because all records of that expedition were so deeply classified by the Third Reich after it happened that no one really knows anything about it. The other odd circumstance that points to something going on in Antarctica by the Nazis is the fact that at the end of the war, several U-boats, cargo-carrying U-boats, turn up about 3 to 4 months after the German surrender in Argentina. And when the Argentine authorities question these U-boat captains as to where they've been and what have they been doing for the last 4 months, you know, the answer is basically, oh, we were just sort of sailing around. Well, you know, most likely they were doing something in Antarctica, but nobody really knows what.
One of our listeners had sent me an email last night. His name is Roger in Atlanta. He sent this to ask about Nazi expeditions into the Himalayas. Is there any...
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar? Is there a connection?
Oh, yes. There is definitely a connection. The SS, prior to the war, had a branch or a department that was set up by Reichsfuhrer Himmler himself called the Ahnenerbe-Dienst, and its sole purpose was to investigate avenues of the occult and of the esoteric for the purposes of military exploitation. Now, Himmler sponsored an expedition to Tibet, to the Himalayas, in 1938 and early 1939. There's just been a book come out about that expedition. As a matter of fact, I forget what the title is right offhand, but this expedition did go to Tibet, and it did make its way all the way to Lhasa and even into the Potala itself. And the expedition returned to Germany with a complete set of the Tibetan Kangshur, which is a very, very ancient set of Tibetan Buddhist manuscripts, hundreds if not thousands of years old. Most of it has never been translated into any Western language, and nobody really knows what happened to that edition of the Kangshur after the war. It simply falls off the face of the map. So yes, there is definitely a connection with all of this stuff.
I'd also been told by a listener about something called Hanabu Project, which I guess was these flying discs, and some research into that. And there was speculation that Rear Admiral Richard Byrd, who went to Antarctica to look around, might have encountered something like that. I know it's wild speculation, but any connection to that, Hanabu or Byrd?
Well, there's actually two questions there. I've never been satisfied that any of those photographs or drawings of the so-called Hanabu flying discs are, in fact, legitimate. I think that they might be very clever disinformation. That being said, Admiral Byrd outfitted an entire expedition to go to Antarctica after the war, interestingly enough, in the year 1947. It was outfitted for a stay of 8 months. It took a battalion of Marines, a light aircraft escort carrier, several destroyers and destroyer escorts, and a submarine seaplane tender. And in other words, this is a large military operation. It's outfitted for 8 weeks instead, after a mere 8 weeks, Admiral Byrd calls it quits and hightails it back to the United States. But along the way, he gives an interview for the El Mercurio newspaper in Santiago de Chile, in which he says, and I reproduce the actual article in Reich of the Black Sun, the Spanish version, so you can actually see this article. In the interview, he tells the reporter that the United States has to prepare itself for enemy fighters that can fly from pole to pole with tremendous speed. So there's always been speculation that he encountered some of these Nazis and their advanced projects down in Antarctica.
Wow.
Yeah.
any indication of who would know about this stuff now? Would I asked you about JFK, but would Bush know? Guessing, I guess.
That's a real big box to open up right before the top of the hour.
Well, it's the same question that people have asked about UFOs.
Sure.
Would the president be informed?
Well, I think to a certain extent, with the Bush family, we're dealing with a very special case because their connections with the Germans go back prior to World War II, and they're rather murky connections at that. My suspicion is that President Bush would probably be one of the better informed presidents on the subject, and even more particularly his father.
Any kind of indication that there's any? I mean, Area 51. We've mentioned this, and you'd figure if something like that really fell into our hands, that Area 51 would be one of the places where we might test it. Sure. Have you ever seen Groom Lake pop up in any of this discussion?
No, I never have. Not to my knowledge. That's not to say that it wouldn't be out there. It's just I haven't run into it, and I do try and do my research rather thoroughly, so I'd lay about a 90% chance that there's not been any mention of it.
Have you had any kind of any people come? Well, I think we're going to go to a break now, and I'll ask this question when we come back, and then we'll be opening it up to phone lines. I'm sure our listeners have many questions for our guest, Dr. Joseph Farrell. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Stick around, everybody.